obsessed. Some of the books weren't in English. Some of the books were dictionaries for the languages that some of the other books were in. Some of the books were actually Sports Illustrated swimsuit editions. Adam felt the familiar pang, not jealousy, just wanting. One day, he'd have enough money to have a place like this, a place that looked on the outside like Adam looked on the inside. A small voice within Adam asked whether he would ever look this grand on the inside, or if it was something you had to be born into. Ganzi was the way he was because he had lived with money when he was small, like a virtuoso placed at a piano bench as soon as he could sit. Adam, a latecomer, a usurper, still stumbled over his clumsy Henrietta accent and kept his change in a cereal box under his bed. Beside Declan, girlfriend held her hands to her chest in an unconscious reaction to masculine nakedness. In this case, the naked party was not a person, but a thing. Ganzi's bed, nothing but two mattresses on a bare metal frame, sitting baldly in the middle of the room, barely made. It was somehow intimate in its complete lack of privacy. Ganzi himself sat at an old desk with his back to them, gazing out an east-facing window and tapping a pen. His fat journal lay open near him, the pages fluttering with glued-in book passages and dark with notes. Adam was struck, as he occasionally was, by Ganzi's agelessness. An old man in a young body, or a young man in an old man's life. "It's us," Adam said. When Ganzi didn't reply, Adam led the way to his oblivious friend. Girlfriend made a variety of noises that all began with the letter O. With a variety of cereal boxes, packing containers, and house paint, Ganzi had built a knee-high replica of the town of Henrietta in the center of the room, and so the three visitors were forced to walk down Main Street in order to reach the desk. Adam knew the truth. These buildings were a symptom of Ganzi's insomnia, a new wall for every night awake. Adam stopped just beside Ganzi. The area around him smelled strongly of mint from the leaf he chewed absently. Adam tapped the earbud in Ganzi's right ear, and his friend startled. Ganzi jumped to his feet. "Why, hello!" As always, there was an all-American war hero look to him, coated in his tousled brown hair, his summer-narrowed hazel eyes, the straight nose that ancient Anglo-Saxons had graciously passed on to him. Everything about him suggested valor and power and a firm handshake. Girlfriend stared. Adam remembered finding him intimidating when he first met him. There were two Ganzis, the one who lived inside his skin and the one Ganzi put on in the morning when he slid his wallet into the back pocket of his chinos. The former was troubled and passionate, with no discernible accent to Adam's ears, and the latter bristled with latent power as he greeted people with the slippery, handsome accent of old Virginia money. It was a mystery to Adam how he could not seem to see both versions of Ganzi at the same time. "I didn't hear you knock," Ganzi said unnecessarily. He knocked fists with Adam. Coming from Ganzi, the gesture was at once charming and self-conscious, a borrowed phrase of another language. "Ashley, this is Ganzi," Declan said in his pleasant, neutral voice. It was a voice that reported tornado damage and cold fronts. Narrated side effects of small blue pills. Explained the safety procedures of the 747 we're flying in today. He added, "Dick Ganzi?" If Ganzi was thinking Declan's girlfriend was expendable, a renewable resource, he didn't show it. He merely said, voice just a little chilly as he corrected, "As Declan knows, it's my father who's Dick. For me, it's just Ganzi." Ashley looked more shocked than amused. "Dick?" "Family name," Ganzi said, with the weary air of someone trotting out a tired joke. "I try my best to ignore it."
"You're Aglenby, right? This place is crazy. Why don't you live on the school grounds?" Ashley asked.
"Because I own this building," Ganzi said. "It's a better investment than paying for dorm housing. You can't sell your dorm after you're done with school. And where did that money go? Nowhere."
Dick Ganzi III hated to be told that he sounded like Dick Ganzi II, but right then he did. Both of them could trot out logic on a nice little leash wearing a smart plaid jacket when they wanted to.
"God," Ashley remarked. She glanced at Adam.
Her eyes didn't linger, but still he remembered the fray on the shoulder of his sweater.
Don't pick at it. She's not looking at it. No one else notices it.
With effort, Adam squared his shoulders and tried to inhabit the uniform as easily as Gansey or Ronan.
Ash, you won't believe why Gansey came here, of all places, Declan said. Tell her, Gansey.
Gansey couldn't resist talking about Glendower. He never could. He asked, how much do you know about Welsh kings?
Ashley pursed her lips, her fingers pinching the skin at the base of her throat.
Llewellyn? Glendower? English marcher lords?
The smile on Gansey's face could have lit coal mines. Adam hadn't known about Llewellyn or Glendower when he'd first met Gansey. Gansey had needed to describe how Owen Glendower to non-Welsh speakers, a medieval Welsh noble, had fought against the English for Welsh freedom and then, when capture seemed inevitable, disappeared from the island and from history altogether. But Gansey never minded retelling the story. He'd related the events like they'd just happened, thrilled again by the magical signs that had accompanied Glendower's birth, the rumors of his power of invisibility, the impossible victories against larger armies, and finally, his mysterious escape. When Gansey spoke, Adam saw the green swell of the Welsh foothills, the wide, glistening surface of the River Dee, the unforgiving northern mountains that Glendower vanished into. In Gansey's stories, Owain Glyndŵr could never die. Listening to him tell the story now, it was clear to Adam that Glendower was more than a historical figure to Gansey. He was everything Gansey wished he could be, wise and brave, sure of his path, touched by the supernatural, respected by all, survived by his legacy. Gansey, now fully warmed to his tale, enchanted again by the mystery of it, asked Ashley, "Have you heard of the legends of sleeping kings? The legends that heroes like Llewellyn and Glendower and Arthur aren't really dead, but are instead sleeping in tombs, waiting to be woken up?" Ashley blinked vapidly, then said, "Sounds like a metaphor." Perhaps she wasn't as dumb as they thought. "Maybe so," Gansey said. He made a grandiose gesture to the maps on the wall, covered with the ley lines he believed Glendower had traveled along. Sweeping up the journal behind him, he paged through maps and notes as examples. "I think Glendower's body was brought over to the New World, specifically here, Virginia. I want to find where he's buried." To Adam's relief, Gansey left out the part about how he believed the legends that said Glendower was still alive centuries later. He left out the part about how he believed the eternally sleeping Glendower would grant a favor to whoever woke him. He left out the part about how it haunted him, this need to find this long-lost king. He left out the midnight phone calls to Adam when he couldn't sleep for obsessing about his search. He left out the microfiche and the museums, the newspaper features and the metal detectors, the frequent flyer miles and the battered foreign language phrase books. And he left out all the parts about magic and the ley line.
"That's crazy," Ashley said. Her eyes were locked on the journal. "Why do you think he's here?"
There were two possible versions of this answer. One was grounded merely in history and was infinitely suitable for general consumption. The other added divining rods and magic to the equation. Some days, some rotten days, Adam believed the former, and only barely. But being Gansey's friend meant that more often he hoped for the latter. This was where Ronan, much to Adam's dissatisfaction, excelled. His belief in the supernatural explanation was unwavering. Adam's faith was imperfect. Ashley, either because she was transient or because she'd been deemed skeptical, got the historical version. In his best professor voice, Gansey explained a bit about Welsh place names in the area, 15th-century artifacts found buried in Virginia soil, and historical support for an early pre-Columbus Welsh landing in America. Midway through the lecture, Noah, Monmouth Manufacturing's reclusive third resident, emerged from a meticulous room directly next to the office Ronan had claimed as his bedroom. Noah's bed shared the tiny space with a piece of mysterious equipment Adam guessed was some sort of printing press. Noah, stepping farther into the room, didn't so much smile at Ashley as goggle at her. He wasn't the best with new people.
"That's Noah," Declan said.
He said it in a way that confirmed Adam's assumption. Monmouth Manufacturing and the boys who lived in it were a tourist stop for Declan and Ashley, a conversation piece for a later dinner. Noah extended his hand.
"Oh, your hand is cold."
Ashley cupped her fingers against her shirt to warm them.
"I've been dead for 7 years," Noah said. "That's as warm as they get."
Noah, unlike his pristine room, always seemed a little grubby. There was something out of place about his clothing, his mostly combed back, fair hair. His unkempt uniform always made Adam feel a little less like he stuck out.
It was hard to feel like part of the Aglenby crowd when standing next to Gansey, whose crisp as George Washington white-collared shirt alone cost more than Adam's bicycle.
Anyone who said you couldn't tell the difference between a shirt from the mall and a shirt made by a clever Italian man had never seen the latter. Or even Ronan, who had spent $900 on a tattoo merely to piss off his brother.
Ashley's obliging giggle was cut off as Ronan's bedroom door opened. A cloud like there would never be sun again crossed Declan's face. Ronan and Declan Lynch were undeniably brothers with the same dark brown hair and sharp nose, but Declan was solid where Ronan was brittle. Declan's wide jaw and smile said, "Vote for me," while Ronan's buzzed head and thin mouth warned that this species was poisonous.
"Ronan," Declan said. On the phone with Adam earlier, he had asked, "When will Ronan not be available?"
"I thought you had tennis."
"I did," Ronan replied. There was a moment of silence where Declan considered what he wanted to say in front of Ashley, and Ronan enjoyed the effect that awkward silence had on his brother. The two elder Lynch brothers, there were three total at Aglenby, had been at odds for as long as Adam had known them. Unlike most of the world, Gansey preferred Ronan to his elder brother Declan, and so the lines had been drawn. Adam suspected Gansey's preference was because Ronan was earnest, even if he was horrible, and with Gansey, honesty was golden. Declan waited a second too long to speak, and Ronan crossed his arms over his chest.
"You've got quite the guy here, Ashley. You'll have a great night with him, and then some other girl can have a great night with him tomorrow."
A fly buzzed against a window pane far above their heads. Behind Ronan, his door, covered with photocopies of his speeding tickets, drifted closed. Ashley's mouth didn't make an O so much as a sideways D. A second too late, Gansey punched Ronan in the arm.
"He's sorry," Gansey said.
Ashley's mouth was slowly closing. She blinked at the map of Wales and back to Ronan. He'd chosen his weapon well. Only the truth, untempered by kindness.
"My brother is," said Declan, but he didn't finish. There wasn't anything he could say that Ronan hadn't already proven. He said, "We're going now, Ronan. I think you need to reconsider your..." But again, he had no words to end the sentence. His brother had taken all the catchy ones.
Declan snagged Ashley's hand, jerking her attention away and toward the apartment door.
"Declan," Gansey started.
"Don't try to make this better," Declan warned. As he pulled Ashley out into the tiny stairwell and down the stairs, Adam heard the beginnings of damage control.
"He has problems, I told you. I tried to make sure he wouldn't be here. He's the one who found Dad. It messed him up. Let's go get seafood instead. Don't you think we look like lobster tonight? We do."
The moment the apartment door was closed, Gansey said, "Come on, Ronan." Ronan's expression was still incendiary. His code of honor left no room for infidelity, for casual relationships. It wasn't that he didn't condone them. He couldn't understand them.
"So he's a man-whore. It's not your problem," Gansey said. Ronan was not really Gansey's problem either, in Adam's opinion, but they'd had this argument before.
One of Ronan's eyebrows was raised, sharp as a razor.
Gansey strapped his journal closed. "That doesn't work on me. She had nothing to do with you and Declan." He said "you and Declan" like it was a physical object, something you could pick up and look underneath. "You treated her badly. You made the rest of us look bad."
Ronan looked chastened, but Adam knew better. Ronan wasn't sorry for his behavior. He was only sorry that Gansey had been there to see him. What lived between the Lynch brothers was dark enough to hide anyone else's feelings. But surely Gansey knew that as well as Adam. He ran his thumb back and forth across his bottom lip, a habit he never seemed to notice, and Adam never bothered to point out. Catching Adam's gaze, he said, "Christ, now I feel dirty. Come on, let's go to Nino's. We'll get pizza and I'll call that psychic and the whole goddamn world will sort itself out." This was why Adam could forgive that shallow, glossy version of Gansey he'd first met. Because of his money and his good family name, because of his handsome smile and his easy laugh, because he liked people, and despite his fears to the contrary, they liked him back, Gansey could have had any and all of the friends that he wanted. Instead, he had chosen the three of them, three guys who should have, for three different reasons, been friendless. "I'm not coming," Noah said.
"Need some more alone time?" Ronan asked.
"Ronan," Gansey interjected, "set your weapons to stun, will you? Noah, we won't make you eat. Adam?" Adam glanced up, distracted. His mind had wandered from Ronan's bad behavior to Ashley's interest in the journal, and he was wondering if it was more than the ordinary curiosity people possessed when faced with Gansey and his obsessive accessories. He knew Gansey would find him overly suspicious, unnecessarily proprietary of a search Gansey was more than willing to share with most people. But Gansey and Adam sought Glendower for different reasons. Gansey longed for him like Arthur longed for the Grail, drawn by a desperate but nebulous need to be useful to the world, to make sure his life meant something beyond champagne parties and white collars, by some complicated longing to settle an argument that waged deep inside himself. Adam, on the other hand, needed that royal favor. And that meant they needed to be the ones to wake Glendower. They needed to be the ones to find him first. "Parrish?" Gansey repeated. "Come on." Adam made a face. He felt it would take more than pizza to improve Ronan's character. But Gansey was already grabbing the car keys to the pig and stepping around his miniature Henrietta. Even though Ronan was snarling and Noah was sighing and Adam was hesitating, he didn't turn to verify that they were coming. He knew they were. In three different ways, he'd earned them all, days or weeks or months before, and when it came to it, they'd all follow him anywhere. "Excelsior," said Gansey, and shut the door behind them. 5. Barrington Welk was feeling less than sprightly as he slouched down the hall of Whitman House, the Aglenby admin building. It was 5 p.m., the school day well over, and he'd only left his townhouse in order to pick up homework that had to be graded before the next day. Afternoon light spilled in the tall, many-paned windows to his left. On the right was a hum of voices from the staff offices. These old buildings looked like museums at this time of day.
"Barrington, I thought you were out today. You look terrible. Are you sick?"
Welk didn't immediately formulate an answer. For all intents and purposes, he was still out. The question asker was Jonah Milo, the well-scrubbed 11th and 12th grade English teacher. Despite an affinity for plaid and thin-legged corduroy pants, Milo wasn't unbearable, but Welk didn't care to discuss his absence from class this morning with him. St. Mark's Eve was beginning to have a sheen of tradition for him, one that involved spending most of the night getting smashed before falling asleep on his kitchenette floor just before dawn. This year, he'd had the forethought to request St. Mark's Day off. Teaching Latin to Aglenby boys was punishment enough. Teaching it with a hangover was excruciating. Finally, Welk merely held up the grubby stack of handwritten homework assignments as answer. Milo widened his eyes at the sight of the name written on the topmost paper.
"Ronan Lynch? Is that his homework?"
Flipping the stack around to read the name on the front, Welk agreed that it was. As he did, a few boys on their way to crew team practice crashed past, pushing him into Milo. The students probably didn't even realize they were being disrespectful. Welk was barely older than they were, and his dramatically large features made him look younger. It was still easy to mistake him for one of the students. Milo disentangled himself from Welk. "How do you get him to come to class?"
The mere mention of Ronan Lynch's name had scraped something raw inside Welk. Because it was never Ronan by himself, it was Ronan as part of the inseparable threesome. Ronan Lynch, Richard Gansey, and Adam Parrish. All of the boys in his class were affluent, confident, arrogant, but the three of them, more than anyone else, reminded him of what he'd lost. Welk struggled to remember if Ronan had ever missed a class with him. The days of the school year blurred together one long and unending day that began with Welk parking his crappy car next to the beautiful Aglenby cars, shouldering his way past laughing, thoughtless boys, standing in front of a room of students who were glassy-eyed at best and derisive at worst. And at the end of the day, Welk, alone and haunted, never, ever able to forget that he was once one of them. When did this become my life? Welk shrugged.
I don't remember him skipping.
You have him with Gansey, though, don't you? Milo asked. That explains it. Those two are tight as ticks. It was a strange old expression, one that Welk hadn't heard since his own days at Aglenby, when he too had been tight as ticks with his roommate, Cherney. He felt a hollowness inside him, like he was hungry, like he should have stayed home and drank more to commemorate this miserable day. He swam back to the present, looking at the attendance sheet the substitute teacher had left.
Ronan was in class today, but Gansey wasn't. Not in mine, anyway.
Oh, that's probably because of that St. Mark's Day hoopla he was talking about, Milo said.
This got Welk's attention. No one knew that today was St. Mark's Day. No one celebrated St. Mark's Day. Not even St. Mark's mother. Only Welk and Cherney, treasure hunters and troublemakers, cared about its existence.
Welk said, "Beg pardon?"
"I don't know what all's going on," Milo replied. One of the other teachers said hi to him on the way out of the staff room, and Milo looked over his shoulder to reply. Welk imagined grabbing Milo's arm, forcing his attention back his way. It took all of his effort to wait instead. Turning back around, Milo seemed to sense Welk's interest because he added,
"He hasn't talked to you about it. He wouldn't shut up about it yesterday. It's that ley line stuff he's always on about."
Ley line. If no one knew about St. Mark's Day, truly no one knew about ley lines. Certainly no one in Henrietta, Virginia. Certainly not one of Aglenby's richest pupils. Definitely not in conjunction with St. Mark's Day. This was Welk's quest, Welk's treasure, Welk's teen years. Why was Richard Gansey III talking about it? With the words ley line spoken aloud, a memory was conjured. Welk in a dense wood, sweat collected on his upper lip. He was 17 and shivering. Every time his heart beat, red lines streaked in the corners of his vision, the trees darkening with his pulse. It made the leaves seem like they were all moving, though there was no wind. Cherney was on the ground, not dead, but dying. His legs still pedaled on the uneven surface beside his red car, making drifts of fallen leaves behind him. His face was just done. In Welk's head, unearthly voices hissed and whispered, words blurred and stretched together.
"Some sort of energy source or something," Milo said.
Welk was suddenly afraid that Milo could see the memory on him, could hear the inexplicable voices in his head, incomprehensible but nonetheless present ever since that failed day. Welk schooled his features, though what he was really thinking was, "If someone else is looking here, I must have been right. It must be here."
What did he say he was doing with the ley line? He asked with studied calm.
"I don't know. Ask him about it. I'm sure he'd love to talk your ear off about it."
Milo looked over his shoulder as the secretary joined them in the hall, her bag on her arm, her jacket in her hand. Her eyeliner was smudged after a long day in the office.
"We talking about Gansey III and his New Age obsession?" the secretary asked.
She had a pencil stuck in her hair to keep it up, and Welk stared at the stray strands that wound up around the lead.
It was clear to him from the way she stood that she secretly found Milo attractive, despite the plaid and the corduroy and the beard. She asked, "Do you know how much Gansey Sr. is worth? I wonder if he knows what his kid spends all his time on. Man, sometimes these entitled little bastards make me want to slit my wrists. Jonah, are you coming with me for a smoke break or not?"
"I quit," said Milo. He cast a quick, uneasy glance from the secretary to Welk, and Welk knew he was thinking about how much Welk's father had been worth once upon a time, and how little he was worth now, long after the trials had left the front pages of the newspapers. All the junior faculty and the admin staff hated the Aglenby boys, hated them for what they had and what they stood for, and Welk knew they were all secretly pleased that he had fallen down among their ranks.
"How about you, Barry?" the secretary asked. Then she answered her own question. "No, you don't smoke. You're too pretty for that. Oh, well, I'll go myself."
Milo turned to go as well.
"Feel better,"
he said kindly, although Welk had never said he was sick. The voices in Welk's head were a roar, but for once his own thoughts had drowned them out.
"I think I do already," said Welk. It was possible that Cherney's death wasn't for nothing after all.
6.
Blue wouldn't really describe herself as a waitress. After all, she also taught penmanship to third graders, made wreaths for the Society for Ladies of Perpetual Health, walked dogs that belonged to inhabitants of Henrietta's poshest condo complex, and replaced bedding plants for the elderly ladies of their neighborhood. Really, being a waitress at Nino's was the least of things she did. But the hours were flexible. It was the most legitimate-looking entry on her already bizarre resume, and it certainly paid the best. There was really only one problem with Nino's, and it was that for all practical purposes it belonged to Aglenby. The restaurant was 6 blocks over from the iron-gated Aglenby campus at the very edge of the historic downtown. It wasn't the nicest place in Henrietta. There were others with bigger televisions and louder music, but none of them had managed to grip the school's imagination like Nino's. Just to know that Nino's was the place to be was a rite of passage. If you could be seduced by Morton's Sports Bar on 3rd, you didn't deserve to be in the inner circle. So the Aglenby boys at Nino's were not just Aglenby students, but they were the most Aglenby that the school had to offer. Loud, pushy, entitled. Blue had seen enough of the Raven boys to last a lifetime. Tonight, the music was already loud enough to paralyze the finer parts of her personality. She tied on her apron, tuned out the Beastie Boys as best she could, and put her tip-earning smile on. Close to the beginning of her shift, 4 boys came through the front door, letting a cold hiss of fresh air into the room that smelled of oregano and beer. In the window beside the boys, a neon light that said, "Since 1976, lit their faces a limesickle green. The boy in front was talking on his cell phone, even as he showed Chialina 4 fingers to indicate party size. Raven boys were good at multitasking, so long as all tasks were exclusively to benefit themselves. As Chialina hurried by, her apron pocket stuffed with tickets to deliver, Blue handed her 4 greasy menus. Chialina's hair floated above her head with static electricity and abject stress. Blue asked, very unwilling, "Do you want me to take that table?"
"Are you kidding?"
Chialina replied, eyeing the 4 boys. Having finally ended his call, the first one slid into one of the orange vinyl booths. The tallest of them knocked his head on the green cut glass light hanging over the table. The others laughed generously at him. He said, "Bitch." A tattoo snaked out above his collar as he swiveled to sit down. There was something hungry about all of the boys. Blue didn't want them anyway. What she wanted was a job that wouldn't suck all the thoughts out of her head and replace them with the leering call of a synthesizer. Sometimes Blue would creep outside for an infinitesimal break, and as she lay her head back against the brick wall of the alley behind the restaurant, she'd dream idly about careers studying tree rings, swimming with manta rays, scouring Costa Rica to find out more about the scale-crested pygmy tyrant. Really, She didn't know if she'd truly like to find out more about the pygmy tyrant. She just liked the name, because for a 5-foot-tall girl, pygmy tyrant sounded like a career. All of those imagined lives seemed pretty far away from Nino's. Just a few minutes after Blue's shift began, the manager signaled to Blue from the kitchen. Tonight, it was Donnie. Nino's had about 15 managers, all of them related to the owner and none of them high school graduates. Donnie managed to both lounge and offer the phone at once. Your parent, mother. But there was no need to clarify because Blue didn't really know who her other parent was. Actually, she'd tried to pester Maura about her father before, but her mother had neatly slithered out of that line of questioning. Plucking the phone from Donnie's hand, Blue tucked herself back into the corner of the kitchen, next to a terminally greasy fridge and a large basin sink. Despite her care, she still got jostled every few moments. Mom, I'm working. Don't panic. Are you sitting? You probably don't need to sit. Well, possibly. At least lean on something. He called to schedule a reading. Who, Mom? Speak louder. It's loud here. Ganzi. For a moment, Blue didn't understand. Then realization tumbled down, weighting her feet. Her voice was a bit faint. When did you schedule it for? Tomorrow afternoon. It was the fastest I could get him in. I tried to get him in sooner, but he said he had school. Do you have a shift tomorrow? I'm changing it, Blue replied immediately. It was someone else saying the words, though. The real Blue was back in the churchyard, hearing his voice say, Ganzi. Yes, you are. Go work. As she hung up, she could feel her pulse fluttering. It was real. He was real. It was all true and terribly, terribly specific. It seemed foolish to be here now, bussing tables and filling drinks and smiling at strangers. She wanted to be home, leaning back against the cool bark of the spreading beech tree behind the house, trying to decide what this changed about her life. Neve had said this was the year she'd fall in love. Moore had said that she'd kill her true love if she kissed him. Ganzi was supposed to die this year. What were the odds? Ganzi had to be her true love. He had to be, because there was no way she was going to kill someone. Is this the way life is supposed to be? Maybe it would be better not to know. Something touched her shoulder. Touching was strictly against Blue's policy. No one was to touch her person while she was at Nino's, and especially no one was to touch her now when she was having a crisis. She whirled. Can I help you? Before her stood the multitasking cell phone Aglinby boy, looking tidy and presidential. His watch looked as if it cost more than her mother's car, and every area of exposed skin was a flattering shade of tan. Blue had never figured out how Aglinby boys managed to tan earlier than locals. It probably had something to do with things like spring break and places like Costa Rica and the Spanish coast. President Cellphone had probably been closer to a pygmy tyrant than she would ever be. I certainly hope so, he said in a way that indicated less hope and more certainty. He had to speak loudly to be heard, and he had to incline his head to meet her eyes. There was something annoyingly impressive about him, an impression that he was very tall, although he was no taller than most boys. My socially inhibited friend, Adam, thinks you're cute, but he's unwilling to make a move. Over there. Not the smudgy one. Not the sulky one. Blue, largely against her will, glanced to the booth he pointed to. 3 boys sat at it. One was smudgy, just as he said, with a rumpled, faded look about his person, like his body had been laundered too many times. The one who'd hit the light was handsome, and his head was shaved, a soldier in a war where the enemy was everyone else. And the third was elegant. It was not the right word for him, but it was close. He was fine-boned and a little fragile-looking, with blue eyes pretty enough for a girl. Despite her better instincts, Blue felt a flutter of interest. So? She asked. So would you do me a favor and come over and talk to him? Blue used 1 millisecond of her time to imagine what that might be like, throwing herself at a booth of Raven Boys and wading through awkward, vaguely sexist conversation. Despite the comeliness of the boy in the booth, it was not a pleasant millisecond.
What exactly is it you think I'm going to talk to him about?
President's cell phone looked unconcerned.
We'll think of something. We're interesting people.
Blue doubted it, but the elegant boy was rather elegant, and he looked genuinely horrified that his friend was talking to her, which was slightly endearing. For one brief moment that she was later ashamed of and bemused by, Blue considered telling President's cell phone when her shift ended. But then Donnie called her name from the kitchen, and she remembered rules number 1 and 2. She said, "Do you see how I'm wearing this apron? It means I'm working for a living." The unconcerned expression didn't flag. He said, "I'll take care of it." She echoed, "Take care of it?" "Yeah. How much do you make in an hour?" "I'll take care of it. And I'll talk to your manager." For a moment, Blue was actually lost for words. She had never believed people who claimed to be speechless, but she was. She opened her mouth, and at first all that came out was air. Then something like the beginning of a laugh. Then finally she managed to sputter, "I am not a prostitute." The Aglenby boy appeared puzzled for a long moment, and then realization dawned. "Oh, that was not how I meant it. That is not what I said." "That is what you said. You think you can just pay me to talk to your friend? Clearly you pay most of your female companions by the hour and don't know how it works with the real world. But... Blue remembered that she was working to a point, but not what that point was. Indignation had eliminated all higher functions, and all that remained was the desire to slap him. The boy opened his mouth to protest, and her thought came back to her all in a rush. Most girls, when they're interested in a guy, will sit with them for free. To his credit, the Aglenby boy didn't speak right away. Instead, he thought for a moment, and then he said without heat, "You said you were working for a living. I thought it'd be rude to not take that into account. I'm sorry you're insulted. I see where you're coming from, but I feel it's a little unfair that you're not doing the same for me." "I feel you're being condescending," Blue said. In the background, she caught a glimpse of Soldier Boy making a plane of his hand. It was crashing and weaving toward the table surface while Smudgy Boy gulped laughter down. The elegant boy held his palm over his face in exaggerated horror, fingers spread just enough that she could see his wince. "Dear God," remarked cell phone boy, "I don't know what else to say." "Sorry," she recommended. "I said that already." Blue considered. "Then bye." He made a little gesture at his chest that she thought was supposed to mean he was curtsying or bowing or something sarcastically gentlemanlike. Calla would have flipped him off, but Blue just stuffed her hands in her apron pockets. As President's cell phone headed back to his table and picked up a fat leather journal that seemed incongruous with the rest of him, the soldier boy let out a derisive laugh and she heard him mimic, "Not a prostitute." Beside him, the elegant boy ducked his head. His ears were bright pink. "Not for $100, Blue thought. "Not for $200. But she had to confess she was a little undone by the blushing ears. It didn't seem very Aglenby. Did Raven Boys get embarrassed? She'd stared a moment too long. The elegant boy looked up and caught her gaze. His eyebrows were drawn together, remorseful rather than cruel, making her doubt herself. But then she flushed, hearing again President Cell Phone's voice saying, "I'll take care of it." She shot him a foul look, a real Calla number, and whirled back toward the kitchen. Neve had to be wrong. She'd never fall in love with one of them. 7. "Tell me again," Gansey asked Adam, "why you think a psychic is a good idea?" The pizzas had been demolished, no help from Noah, which made Gansey feel better and Ronan feel worse. By the end of the meal, Ronan had picked off all his moving dolly scabs, and he would have picked off Adams as well if he'd let him. Gansey sent him outside to blow off steam and Noah to babysit him. Now Gansey and Adams stood in line while a woman argued about mushroom topping with the cashier. "They deal in energy work," said Adam, just loud enough to be heard over the blaring music. He studied his arm where he'd worried his own scab off. The skin beneath looked a little angry. Looking up, he peered over his shoulder, probably looking for the evil, not a prostitute, waitress. Part of Gansey felt guilty for botching Adam's chances with her. The other part felt he'd possibly saved Adam from having his spinal cord ripped out and devoured. It was possible, Gansey thought, that he'd once again been oblivious about money. He hadn't meant to be offensive, but in retrospect, it was possible he had been. This was going to eat at him all evening. He vowed, as he had 100 times before, to consider his words better. Adam continued, "The ley lines, her energy, energy and energy." "Matchy, matchy," Gansey replied, "if the psychic is for real." Adam said, "Beggars can't be choosers." Gansey looked at the handwritten ticket for the pizza in his hand. According to the bubbly writing, their waitress's name had been Chialina. She'd included her telephone number, but it was hard to say which boy she'd been hoping to attract. Some of the parties at the table were less dangerous to consort with than others. She clearly hadn't found him condescending, which was probably because she hadn't heard him speak. All night. This was going to bother him. All night. He said, "I wish we had a sense of how wide the lines were. I don't know if we're looking for a thread or a highway, even after all this time. We could have been feet away from it and never known." Adam's neck might have broken from all the looking around he was doing. There was still no sign of the waitress. He looked tired, up too late, too many nights in a row working and studying. Gansey hated seeing him like this, but nothing he thought of in his head sounded like something he could actually say to him. Adam wouldn't tolerate pity. "We know they can be doused, so they can't be that narrow," Adam said. He rubbed the back of his hand against his temple. That was what had brought Gansey to Henrietta in the first place. Months of dowsing and research. Later, he'd tried to douse the line more precisely with Adam. They'd circled the town with a willow divining rod and an electromagnetic frequency reader, swapping the instruments between the two of them. The machine had spiked strangely a few times, and Gansey had thought he'd felt the divining rod twitch in his hands in time with it, but it might have been wishful thinking by that point. "I could tell him his grades are going to go to hell if he doesn't cut back on his hours," Gansey thought, looking at the dark skin beneath Adam's eyes. If he made it about him, Adam wouldn't interpret it as charity. He considered how to frame it so that it sounded selfish. "You're no good to me if you get mono or something." Adam would see through that in a second. Instead, Gansey said, "We need a solid point A before we even start thinking about point B." But they had point A. They even had point B. The problem was just that the points were too large. Gansey had a map torn from a book depicting Virginia with the ley line marked darkly across it. Like the ley line enthusiasts in the UK, American ley line seekers determined key spiritual places and drew lines between them until the arc of the ley line became obvious. It seemed like all the work had been done for them already. But the creators of those maps had never meant for them to be used as road maps. They were too approximate. One of the maps listed merely New York City, Washington, D.C., and Pilot Mountain, North Carolina as possible reference points. Each of those points was miles wide, and even the finest of pencil lines drawn on a map was no narrower than 35 feet, even eliminating the possibilities left them with thousands of acres where the ley line could be, thousands of acres where Glendower could be, if he was along the ley line at all. "I wonder," Adam mused aloud, "if we could electrify either the rods or the line, hook up a car battery to them or something. If you got a loan, you could stop working until after college." No, that would immediately birth an argument. Gansey shook his head a little, more at his own thoughts than at Adam's comment. He said, "That sounds like either the beginning of a torture session or a music video." Adam's searching for devil waitress face had given way to his brilliant idea face. The fatigue melted away. "Well, amplification, that's all I was thinking. Something to make it louder and easier to follow." It wasn't an awful idea. Last year in Montana, Gansey had interviewed a lightning strike victim. The boy had been sitting on his ATV in the doorway of a cattle barn when he was struck, and the incident had left him with an inexplicable fear of being indoors and an uncanny ability to follow one of the western ley lines using only a bent bit of radio antenna. For 2 days, they trailed together across fields carved by glaciers and marked by round hay bales higher than their heads, finding hidden water sources and tiny caves and lightning-burned stumps and strangely marked stones. Gansey had tried to convince the boy to come back to the East Coast to perform his same miracle on the ley line there, but the boy's newly pathological fear of the indoors ruled out all plane and car travel. And it was a long walk. Still, it wasn't an entirely useless exercise. It was further proof of the amorphous theory Adam had just described. Ley lines and electricity could be linked. Energy and energy. Matchy, matchy. As he moved up to the counter, Gansey became aware that Noah was lurking at his elbow, looking strained and urgent. Both were typical for Noah, so Gansey was not immediately troubled. He passed a folded-over packet of bills to the cashier. Noah continued to hover. "Noah, what?" demanded Gansey. Noah seemed about to put his hands in his pockets and then didn't. Noah's hands seemed to belong fewer places than other people's. He eventually just let them hang as he looked at Gansey. He said, "Declan's here." An immediate scan of the restaurant offered nothing. Gansey demanded, "Where?" "Parking lot," Noah said. "He and Ronan." Not bothering to wait for the rest of the sentence, Gansey burst out into the black evening. Scrambling around the side of the building, he skidded onto the parking lot just in time to see Ronan throw a punch. The swing was infinite. From the looks of it, it was the opening act. In the sickly green light of a buzzing street lamp, Ronan had an unbreakable stance and an expression hard as granite. There was no wavering in the line of the blow. He had accepted the consequences of wherever his fist landed long before he began the punch. From his father, Gansey had gotten a head for logic, an affection for research, and a trust fund the size of most state lotteries. From their father, the Lynch brothers had gotten indefatigable egos, a decade of obscure Irish music instrument lessons, and the ability to box like they meant it. Neil Lynch had not been around very much, but when he had been an excellent teacher. "Ronan!" Gansey shouted too late. Declan went down, but before Gansey even had time to form a plan of action, he was back up again, fist smacking into his brother. Ronan released a string of profanity so varied and pointed that Gansey was amazed that the words alone didn't slay Declan. Arms windmilled, knees met chests, elbows rammed into faces. Then Ronan grabbed Declan's suit coat and used it to throw him onto the mirror-like hood of Declan's Volvo. "Not the fucking car," snarled Declan, his lip bloody. The story of the Lynch family was this. Once upon a time, a man named Neil Lynch had 3 sons, one of whom loved his father more than the others. Neil Lynch was handsome and charismatic and rich and mysterious, and one day he was dragged from his charcoal gray BMW and beaten to death with a tire iron. It was a Wednesday. On Thursday, his son Ronan found his body in the driveway. On Friday, their mother stopped speaking and never spoke again. On Saturday, the Lynch brothers found that their father's death left them rich and homeless. The will forbade them to touch anything in the house, their clothing, the furniture, their silent mother. The will demanded they immediately move into Aglenby housing. Declan, the eldest, was meant to control the funds and their lives until his brothers reached 18. On Sunday, Ronan stole his deceased father's car. On Monday, the Lynch brothers stopped being friends. Ripping Ronan from the Volvo, Declan hit his brother hard enough that even Gansey felt it. Ashley, her light hair more visible than the rest of her, blinked at him from inside the Volvo. Gansey took several strides across the lot. "Ronan!" Ronan didn't even turn his head. A grim smile, more skeleton than boy, was etched onto his mouth as the brothers whirled around. This was a real fight, not for show, and it played in fast forward.
Someone would be unconscious before Gansey had time to cry havoc, and he just didn't have time to take someone to the ER tonight. Gansey sprang, seizing Ronan's arm in mid-swing. Ronan still had his fingers hooked inside Declan's mouth, though, and Declan already had a fist flying from behind like a violent embrace. So it was Gansey who got Declan's blow. Something wet misted his arm. He was fairly certain it was spit, but it was possible it was blood. He shouted a word he'd learned from his sister Helen. Ronan had Declan by the knot of his burgundy tie, and Declan gripped the back of his brother's skull with one white-knuckled hand. Gansey might as well have not been there. With a neat flick of his wrist, Ronan smacked Declan's head off the driver's side door of the Volvo. It made a sick, wet sound. Declan's hand fell away. Gansey seized the opportunity to propel Ronan about 5 feet away. Jerking in his grip, Ronan jackrabbited his legs on the pavement. He was unbelievably strong. "Quit it," Gansey panted. "You're ruining your face." Ronan twisted, all muscle and adrenaline. Declan, his suit looking more bedraggled than any suit ought to look, started back toward them. He had a hell of a bruise rising on his temple, but he looked ready to go again. There was no way of telling what had set them off. A new home nurse for their mother, a poor grade at school, an unexplained credit card bill, maybe just Ashley. Across the lot, the manager of Nino's emerged from the front entrance. It wouldn't be long before the cops were called. Where was Adam? "Declan," Gansey said, voice full of warning, "if you come back over here, I swear." With a jerk of his chin, Declan spit blood at the pavement. His lip was bleeding, but his teeth were still good.
"Fine. He's your dog, Gansey. You leash him. Keep him from getting kicked out of Aglenby. I wash my hands of him."
"I wish," snarled Ronan. His entire body was rigid under Gansey's hand. He wore his hatred like a cruel second skin. Declan said, "You're such a piece of shit, Ronan. If Dad saw..." And this made Ronan burst forward again. Gansey clamped arms around Ronan's chest and dragged him back. "Why are you even here?" Gansey asked Declan.
"Ashley had to use the bathroom," Declan replied crisply. "I should be able to stop where I like, don't you think?"
The last time Gansey had been in the Nino's co-ed bathroom, it had smelled like vomit and beer. On one of the walls, a red Sharpie had scrawled the word Beelzebub and Ronan's number below. It was hard to imagine Declan choosing to inflict Nino's facilities on his girlfriend. Gansey's voice was short. "I think you should just go. This isn't getting solved tonight." Declan laughed, just once, a big careless laugh full of round vowels. He clearly found nothing about Ronan funny.
"Ask him if he's going to get by with a B this year," he told Gansey. "Do you ever go to class, Ronan?"
Behind Declan, Ashley peered out of the driver's side window. She'd rolled down the window to listen. She didn't look nearly as much like an idiot when she thought no one was paying any attention to her. It seemed like justice that perhaps this time Declan was the one getting played.
"I'm not saying you're wrong, Declan," Gansey said.
His ear throbbed where it had been boxed. He could feel Ronan's pulse crashing in his arm where he restrained him. His vow to consider his words more carefully came back to him, and so he framed the rest of the statement in his head before saying it out loud.
"But you are not Neil Lynch, and you won't ever be, and you get ahead a lot faster if you stopped trying."
Gansey released Ronan. Ronan didn't move, though, and neither did Declan. As if by saying their father's name, Gansey had cast a spell. They wore matching raw expressions, different wounds inflicted by the same weapon.
"I'm only trying to help," Declan said finally, but he sounded defeated.
There was a time, a few months ago, when Gansey would have believed him. Next to Gansey, Ronan's hands hung open at his sides. Sometimes, after Adam had been hit, there was something remote and absent in his eyes, like his body belonged to someone else. When Ronan was hit, it was the opposite. He became so urgently present that it was as if he'd been sleeping before. Ronan told his brother, "I'll never forgive you." The Volvo's window hissed closed, as if Ashley had just realized that this had become a conversation she wasn't meant to hear.
Sucking on his bloody lip, Declan looked at the ground for a bare moment. Then he straightened and adjusted his tie.
"Wouldn't mean much from you anymore," he said, and tugged open the Volvo's door. As he slid into the driver's seat, Declan said, "I don't want to talk about it," to Ashley, and slammed the door shut. The Volvo's tires squealed as they bit into the pavement, and then Gansey and Ronan were left standing next to each other in the strange, dim light of the parking lot. A block away, a dog barked balefully 3 times. Ronan touched his pinky finger to his eyebrow to check for blood, but there was none, just a raised, angry bump.
"Fix it," Gansey said.
He wasn't entirely sure that whatever Ronan had done or failed to do was easily corrected, but he was sure that it must be corrected. The only reason Ronan was allowed to stay at Monmouth Manufacturing was because his grades were acceptable. "Whatever it is, don't let him be right," Ronan said low just for Gansey.
"I want to quit.
One more year."
"I don't want to do this for another year."
He kicked a piece of gravel under the Camaro. Now his voice did rise, but only in ferocity, not in volume.
"Another year and then I get strangled with a necktie like Declan? I'm not a damn politician, Gansey. I'm not a banker."
Gansey wasn't either, but it didn't mean he wanted to leave school. The pain in Ronan's voice meant he couldn't have any in his when he said, "Just graduate and do whatever you want." The trust funds from their fathers had ensured that neither of them had to work for a living ever if they didn't choose to. They were extraneous parts in the machine that was society, a fact that sat differently on Ronan's shoulders than Gansey's. Ronan looked angry, but he was in the mood where he was going to look angry no matter what.
"I don't know what I want. I don't know what the hell I am."
He got into the Camaro.
"You promised me," Gansey said through the open car door. Ronan didn't look up. "I know what I did, Gansey. Don't forget."
When Ronan slammed the door, it echoed across the parking lot in the too loud way of sounds after dark. Gansey joined Adam at his safely distant vantage point. In comparison to Ronan, Adam looked clean, self-contained, utterly in control. From somewhere he had gotten a rubber ball printed with a SpongeBob logo, and he bounced it with a pensive expression. "I convinced them not to call the cops," Adam said. He was good at making things quiet. Gansey let out his breath. Tonight he didn't have it in him to talk to the police on Ronan's behalf. "Tell me I'm doing the right thing with Ronan. Tell me this is how to find the old Ronan. Tell me I'm not ruining him by keeping him away from Declan." But Adam had already told Gansey he thought Ronan needed to learn to clean up his own messes. It was only Gansey who seemed afraid that Ronan would learn to live in the dirt. So he merely asked, "Where's Noah?"
"He's coming. I think he was leaving a tip."
Adam dropped the ball and caught it again. He had an almost mechanical way of snapping his fingers around the ball as it bounced back toward him. One moment his hand was open and empty, and the next tight shut around it. Bounce. Snap. Gansey said, "So, Ashley."
"Yes," Adam replied, as if he'd been waiting for him to bring her up.
"Quite some eyes on her." It was an expression his dad used all the time, a family catchphrase for someone nosy. Adam asked,
"Do you think she's really here for Declan?"
"Why else would she be here?"
"Glendower," Adam replied immediately.
Gansey laughed, but Adam didn't.
"Really? Why else?"
Instead of answering, Adam twisted his hand and released the rubber ball. He'd chosen his trajectory carefully. The ball bounced off the greasy asphalt once, struck one of the Camaro's tires, and arced high in the air, disappearing in the black. He stepped forward in time for it to slap in his palm. Gansey made an approving noise. Adam said,
"I don't think you should talk to people about it anymore."
"It's not a secret."
"Maybe it should be."
Adam's uneasiness was contagious, but logically there was nothing to support suspicion. For 4 years, Gansey had been searching for Glendower, freely admitting this fact to all and any who showed interest, and he'd never seen the slightest evidence of anyone else sharing his precise quest. He had to admit, however, that the suggestion of that possibility gave him a peculiarly unpleasant feeling. He said, "It's all out there, Adam. Pretty much everything I've done is public record. It's too late for it to be a secret. It was too late years ago.
Come on, Gansy, Adam said with some heat.
Don't you feel it?
Don't you feel?
Feel what?
Gansy despised fighting with Adam, and somehow this felt like a fight. Unsuccessfully, Adam struggled to put his thoughts into words. Finally, he replied,
observed.
Across the parking lot, Noah had finally emerged from Nino's, and he slouched toward them. In the Camaro, Ronan's silhouetted form lay back in the seat, head tilted as if he slept. Close by, Gansy could smell roses and grass mowed for the first time that year, and farther away, he smelled damp earth coming to life beneath last year's fallen leaves, and water running over rocks in mountain crooks where humans never walked. Perhaps Adam was right. There was something pregnant about the night, he thought, something out of sight opening its eyes. This time, when Adam dropped the ball, it was Gansey's hand that reached out to snap it up.
Do you think there would be any point to someone spying on us, Gansy said, if we weren't on the right track?
8. By the time Blue made her slow way outside, weariness had extinguished her anxiety. She sucked in a huge breath of the cool night air. It didn't even seem like it could be the same substance that filtered through Nino's air conditioning vents. She tilted her head back to look at the stars. Here, on the edge of downtown, there weren't enough streetlights to obliterate the stars completely. Ursa Major, Leo, Cepheus. Her breaths came easier and slower with each familiar constellation she found. The chain was cold as Blue unlocked her bike. Across the parking lot, muffled conversations faded in and out. Footsteps scuffed across the asphalt somewhere close behind her. Even when they were quiet, people really were the noisiest animals. One day, she would live someplace where she could stand outside her house and see only stars, no street lights, where she could feel as close as she ever got to sharing her mother's gift. When she looked at the stars, something tugged at her, something that urged her to see more than stars, to make sense of the chaotic firmament, to pull an image from it. But it never made sense. She only ever saw Leo and Cepheus, Scorpio and Draco. Maybe she just needed more horizon and less city. The only thing was, she didn't really want to see the future. What she wanted was to see something no one else could see or would see, and maybe that was asking for more magic than was in the world.
Excuse me, miss?
Hi. The voice was careful, masculine, and local. The vowels had all the edges sanded off. Blue turned with a lukewarm expression. To her surprise, it was Elegant Boy, face gaunter and older in the distant streetlight. He was alone. No sign of President's cell phone, the smudgy one, or their hostile friend. One hand steadied his bike. The other was tucked neatly in his pocket. His uncertain posture didn't quite track with the raven-breasted sweater, and she caught a glimpse of a warm bit of seam on the shoulder before he shrugged it under his ear as if he was cold.
Hi, Blue said, softer than she would have if she hadn't noticed the fray. She didn't know what sort of Aglinby boy wore hand-me-down sweaters.
Adam, is it? He gave a jerky, abashed nod. Blue looked at his bike. She didn't know what sort of Aglinby boy rode a bicycle instead of driving a car, either.
I was on my way home, Adam said, and I thought I recognized you over here. I wanted to say sorry about what happened earlier. I didn't tell him to do that, and I wanted you to know.
It didn't escape Blue that his slightly accented voice was as nice as his looks. It was all Henrietta Sunset, hot front porch swings and cold iced tea glasses. Cicadas louder than your thoughts. He glanced over his shoulder, then at the sound of a car on a side street. When he looked back to her, he still wore a wary expression, and Blue saw that this expression, a wrinkle pinched between his eyebrows, mouth tense, was his normal one. It fit his features perfectly, matched up with every line around his mouth and eyes. This Aglinby boy isn't often happy, she thought.
Well, that's nice of you, she said,
but it's not you that needed to apologize. Adam said, I can't let him take all the blame. I mean, he was right. I did want to talk to you, but I didn't want to just try to pick you up. This was where she ought to brush him off, but she was stymied by his blush at the table, his honest expression, his newly minted, uncertain smile. His face was just strange enough that she wanted to keep looking at it. The fact was that she'd never been flirted with by someone who she wanted to succeed at it. Don't do it, warned the voice inside Blue. But she asked, and what is it you wanted to do? Talk, he said. In his local accent, it was a long word, and it seemed less of a synonym for speak than it was for confess. She couldn't help but look at the thin, pleasant line of his mouth. He added, I guess I could have just saved a lot of trouble by coming up to talk to you in the first place. Other people's ideas always seem to get me into more trouble. Blue was about to tell him how Orla's ideas got everyone into trouble at her house, too, but then she realized he would say something else, and then she would reply, and it could go on all night. Something about Adam told her that this was a boy she could have a conversation with. Out of nowhere, Maura's voice was in Blue's head. I don't have to tell you not to kiss anyone, right? And just like that, Blue was done. She was, as Neve pointed out, a sensible girl. Even the very best outcome here could only end in torment. She blew out a breath. It wasn't about what he was saying about you, anyway. It was that he offered me money, she said, putting her foot on the bike pedal. The thing was not to imagine what it would have been like to stay and talk. When Blue didn't have enough money for something, the worst thing in the world was to imagine what it would have been like to have whatever the something was. Adam sighed as if he recognized her retreat. He doesn't know. He's stupid about money. And you aren't. He just leveled her with a very steady look. It wasn't an